Okay, so again, I'm happy to be talking to an audience of astrophysicists because... No, you operate from a different sociological environment than the fluid dynamicist. But it's interesting to see if we can bring it together. That's what this meeting is all about, to see if we can help you and you can help us and we can all move together and argue more cogently rather than very heuristically. Anyway, I have studied recently some of the astrophysics literature, and one paper that interested me, or one author's who interested me, was Gavadamadze. I'm sure he's saying things that others have said before, but he's pointing to data. And really, I just want to get some buzzwords out. And he's talking about a very specific event, and he's talking about a jet. So all these words are in quotes because you don't really know what they are. They're just little ticks on a piece of paper, pixel illumination. And he says here it is suggested that shell deformations, veil of supernova, filamentary structures. We're all talking about filamentary structures, so let's have an explanation. So my focus will be sort of in this environment, okay? It may be general, more general to other environments, but anyway, that is sort of would be my focus. And one of the things I hope that will come from this is that I can sit down with Edith, which we didn't have time to do before this meeting because of last week's meeting, and my son is visiting from Japan, and I had to spend some time with him and other personal problems. But at least we have a talking basis, and this is wonderful. I find it wonderful. So would you believe that vorticity is more complicated than she described? No problem. In fact, the vorticity evolution equation for the Navier-Stokes equation looks like this. So this line here is the Euler equations. And all of this here is the Navier-Stokes equations. So most of us know very well these terms here. Okay, this is just the convection term. This is the so-called vortex stretching term in 3D. This is the so-called dilatation term. And this is a very, very important term that many of us, including Mordechai, who I know in this room, have worked on a lot, the so-called baroclinic vorticity generation term. Okay, the gradient of rho cross the gradient of p. It's a very important term in astrophysics, as it is in geophysics also. In other words, any time you have a stratified medium or a cloud of a different density, then this term has to be extremely important, and that's going to be the basis of my talk. And that is all I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about this, but I want to make one very important point. If you're doing a simulation and you've omitted that term, well, by God, you can be sure you're not getting this from the numerical viscosity. Just remember that. So another aspect of my talk is to be aware of what somebody tells you is in their simulation, because it may not be true, including my own. And just to show you what can happen in a very well-worked problem, for which I was one of the first to work on with Paul Woodward and Karl-Heinz Winkler at Los Alamos in 1987, it's the shock sphere in axisymmetry, also worked on by Mordechai and others. And we have found, by very careful investigation, many very interesting phenomena, more than just the global kinds of things. In fact, after the shock goes by the bubble, I'll return to this at the very end, I just want to show you some of the complex shock structure that exists. Okay, so I have here a Mach 2.5 and a Mach 5 bubble interacting with this. I don't want to get into a lot of detail. All I want you to be aware of is the complexity of the shock structures that form on the downstream side of a bubble. So this little thing in here is the inside of the bubble, a cavity forms, actually, because the shock races around the heavy bubble. And when that bubble, that cavity collapses, it blasts out another wave.
To clarify the terminology, what you're referring to as a bubble would be referred to as a cloud in astrophysics.
No, this... Oh, I'm sorry, yes, you're right. This is called a cloud or a cloudlet. Yeah. When I talk about a bubble, I'm thinking of like a burning a bubble of fuel or something like that. Yes, the droplet. In this droplet, a cavity forms. I will go, if time permits, I will go into it. This is not the important thing. The important thing that I want to show you here is even behind a very simple object, you get a very complex shock structure. That is shocks interacting with shocks. And that will be one of the points I want to make that was completely ignored in the previous speaker's talk. Okay, I'll come back to that again. But I just want to tell you something about the complexity of shock interactions. That was sort of the title of my talk, Deposition of Vorticity by Shock Waves. And I'm not going to think of a shock wave as some large planar thing. Okay? Now, the other aspect of my talk is what I call awareness of algorithms and codes, that is delta x, delta t, and convergence. This is a very big issue which you could spend hours talking about. But many people in this room are using second order and PPM. Others are using higher order, but then when you use higher order, you usually have to do a lower Mach number thing to be realistic. And in all these cases, what you do in the Euler equations, you have an effective Reynolds number, okay? And that's an issue that could be discussed because you've left out the viscosity. Okay, now what are other things to be aware of? There are many things that a person does to make his code go so he can get a result out. And for example, in designing an algorithm, most of the algorithms are not what we call fully multidimensional. Take 2D and 3D. That is, they're made up of one-dimensional sweeps. You sweep this way, you sweep that way, and you sweep this way. Nobody tells you that unless you're an algorithm person. However, the nature of the sweeping directions can introduce false structure. Okay. That's another thing. Then you have filters. In order to compute, typically you have to have things that will put a floor on the density so it doesn't go negative. Most people don't tell you that. And things. But one of the biggest things that I'm concerned about, and if time permits, I'll make you aware of this, is what I call the false diffusion or growth of contact layers. What do I mean by a contact layer? I mean a density inhomogeneity, density jump. Supposing I set up a cloudlet with a very narrow density jump. I just show you a piece of it, okay? So, in my algorithm, I have to have something that's going to track the boundary, and we have what I call level set methods. Most people use them. And here I indicate one medium, and here the other. So usually it's just done in an ad hoc manner. 0.1 is one medium, 0.9 is another. Some people have multi-fluid codes, and I'm not talking about that. Even in those codes, there are problems. You will find out in a very short time, this region grows to be of the same order as the volume or area of the bubble. That's a very touchy point, because if you're doing turbulent mixing, and you'll see this is where the turbulence is, what are you doing? You're diffusing numerically and deciding that this is where the turbulence is. So that's a problem to be aware of. We must proceed. Yeah.
This sweeping is, of course, not necessary. I mean, this really only if people advance the equations in one direction at first.
Yes.
Partially. Yes, okay.
I'm saying most codes are not fully multidimensional.
Okay. And the floor thing, has that ever been proven that this can ever work correctly?
No, that's what I'm saying.
So it works quite wrongly, right?
Well, it's obviously putting in an error.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's severe, isn't it?
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah, it is severe because it's changing the gradient of the density. Right. Okay, so that was just to be to make you aware that you can't just look at a piece of simulation. You have to have a great trust in the person who is doing it based on a reputation. Okay. And I'm sure this is true observationally, but I don't happen to know that. Okay. So this I showed last time, but I want to refresh your memory of what I consider to be geometries to explore the shock cloud interaction. And I will focus on the incline because it's very close to things you could say analytically, But I will also talk about this because I want to show you how to see the how a very important vorticity form arises, not discussed by the previous speaker, namely what I call dipolar vorticity. Dipolar vorticity is the essence of a shock-cloud interaction. That's what this guy Gvaramadze means by a jet. Okay, now you can argue with me, but let's move on. And one aspect of the complexity of vortex interactions, which is highlighted by taking an artificial geometry astrophysically, but not in the laboratory, is this double inclined curtain, that is a layer of density with two interfaces. It's a kind of cloud. Okay, so let me move along and mention some of the things that you are going to see. First of all, we have the shock incline, and I'll call that an I1 configuration. And so we have the Mach number. We have to worry about the density ratio. We have to worry about the ratio of specific heats in each medium. And these are some of the parameters that sort of I won't even talk about to any great extent unless you ask me. One of the important things that is important is, what is the density ratio? Is it the ambient higher or lower than the cloud, okay? So if eta is greater than 1, the cloud is higher in density, and if it's less than 1, it's the cloud is of lower density. And that's very important because it sets the sign of the vorticity. The polarity of the vorticity is determined by whether it's heavier or lighter, and assuming that the shock is going along. By the way, I want to say one thing. Even though I'm talking about shocks, because that is all of my experience, that is 95% of my experience, 5% of my experience is with blast waves. They are very different entities because they are not a constant jump. They fall off afterwards. And this can make a big difference. And I saw it in some calculations by somebody from the Osaka group. So I'm not going to talk about blast wave, which is the typical thing you have in astrophysics, okay? But I'll talk about shock waves. Okay, now one of the important things that arises in a shock wave is a triple point. That is, shock waves, because whenever you do a kind of interaction of waves, like reflection and transmission in a medium, if it's a linear medium, you can satisfy the jump relations. There's no ambiguity. Sometimes you have a kind of complete reflection, like Brewster reflection. But this is not true with shock waves. Shock waves are nonlinear entities, and in order to satisfy the proper boundary conditions of pressure jump and velocity jump, that is just from the momentum equations, you're solving nonlinear equations. And sometimes when you want to solve them, they don't have a solution. So what happens in nature? Well, nature puts in a third shock at that point. And then that third shock, at least one, I don't know, it may put in more, but it puts in at least one, and Mach discovered that. That's called the Mach shock. And so you'll have, that's called the triple point, triple because there are three shocks. And that point has a very large curvature, right? It looks like, instead of a typical example which will show up, is you send a shock into a wall. That wall can, by the way, be a cloud of large density. And in order to try to satisfy the jump relations here, you get you can't get a solution, so nature goes in here and goes this, puts in a stop, and then you have enough regions in order to match the equations. But it also does one other thing in the process. It puts in a vortex layer here, and this is not a trivial thing. Now, whenever you have shocks interacting, you get vortex layers, and in fact, I'll just say a remark. As you raise the Mach number, these become much stronger. And these vortex layers that are generated, that is the circulation, can be as large as the circulation generated baroclinically when the shock hits the cloud. I'll come back to that. Okay.
Was that a boundary or what was the layer?
This is just a boundary. This is a... Okay.
Or is that a shear layer along like
this? This is the shear layer.
Could also be a symmetry.
Yes, it's symmetry, right. Oh, I'm sure.
Point
notice that any time you have a shock interception,
yeah,
you have flows coming through those shocks.
Right. In other words, this, here's the ambient medium, and the shock is going this way. That means there's flow across here. That's a one-dimensional shock. Okay, then if this were a satisfactory condition, you would have a reflected wave, right? And this would be going back. Okay? Well, this reflected wave, if the angle is sufficiently large, will be off the wall. Not my talk, but the wave. And a triple point will arise here. Okay. And out of that triple point will come a shear layer. By the way, there is really no theory for that. It's only computation and observation. But I'll show it to you.
The shear layer is along the wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the point, no, you see, the shear layer has a certain sign. Say, it's this. And therefore, when it hits the wall, it interacts with this mirror image, so it rolls up. Okay?
This is a,
what?
It'll still roll up even if you're in a free stream.
That's a different matter. Okay, yeah, but that's if there's a perturbation on, which there is. That's one of the things I want to come to, right.
In a two-dimensional calculation, axisymmetric, isn't it true that an arcigensis on
that's
the
right, yes.
And then is that stable in 3D?
That's a very good question. I'm coming to that. It's probably not stable. Okay. By the way, one of the things I'm going to say at the end, and of course you realize, I'm not going to mention magnetic fields, which is very important, obviously, in MHD. I'm not going to mention radiation at high temperature. That's obviously very important. And I'm not going to mention chemistry. So there's a whole wide field open before we make contact with astrophysics. But I think these are very intrinsically fundamental processes. And if the magnetic field is not large, this is a very important point, these processes will be extremely important. Nothing. Okay. In fact, I'd like to know, for example, what is this triple point? How does this triple point behave in the magnetic field? Nobody has touched that as far as I'm concerned. It's a very singular solution, okay? I'll tell you, show you that in a minute. Okay.
I mean, I published computations of shock triple points with MHD. I didn't do many measurements.
Okay, well, we can talk about it. In fact, Mordechai, who I'm pleased to meet, I've known him by reputation, has given me some papers which will set the basis for a lot of discussion, I'm sure. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the double incline. I hope to talk about it. And you will see what we have, colliding vortex sheets. And this must be a common process in this kind of turbulence because you have dipoles. Okay, well, if you haven't heard about it, you'll see it here for the first time. Then I'll go to the shock cylinder and sphere and elucidate this, what's happening on the backside, the region where a wake forms, okay? And the so-called deposited double layers. I have a little heuristic model which we are presently quantifying. But it explains certain structure that people have seen, first observed, by the way, by Klein, McKee, and Colella in their, I think, 92 paper. And then, if time permits, I'll talk about diffusion, false diffusion. Yeah.
Let me just make a point about the astrophysical application.
Yeah.
For approximately 10 to 20 years, people, spurred on by the cartoon in Mickey and Ostrecker's favor, have been looking for the interaction of shocks with small spherical clouds. And the answer after 20 years' search is there are vanishingly small numbers of these in astrophysical situations. For example, the image shown in Klein, McKee, and Colella that they suggested to be such a shock was later proven by Graham and several other people at Berkeley to be actually the start of an interaction with a much larger cloud where the wave was just beginning to wrap around a much larger irregular sheet-like thing with the nose. And that was typical rather than atypical of this search for interactions with spherical clouds. The general conclusion, and if anybody here would like to differ, please do, I would say the general astrophysical conclusion is that the structures we're seeing are not small round clouds, but rather sheets and maybe filamentary structures. And furthermore, that they're probably an intrinsic part of the turbulent flow, as the simulations that they did show would suggest. That is, that the density enhancements that you see are caused by the shocks rather than being sort of separate objects that gets hit by a shock.
Okay. Well, the answer is, what about the next shock that comes by?
That will then actually be part of the interactions as well, but you'll always get if you look at these, you'll never see one of these isolated things getting hit by a shock.
Well, first of all, I'm going to say that what I'm talking about is the interaction of shocks with shocks, okay? And you haven't elucidated that, and we just pointed out here that we don't really know how. Okay. And the fact that I'm using a spherical cloud is only an idealization. I could use anything. In fact, I could use a weak density structure, because when the shock comes along, it just immediately steepens it up to a strong density structure. If the shock is greater than 2, that's what happens. Now, mathematically, you can solve in some cases. I showed this last time, but I want to iterate it. This is an incoming shock, okay? This is a density jump. This green line is a density jump. And the shock actually turns. It exerts a torque on the interface, turns it. You get the reflected shock here, the transmitted shock here, and along here, this red line is a vortex layer, sheet, ideally. By the way, so these sheets obviously are not resolved in anybody's code. They're of the order of 2 delta x. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. I just wanted to point out that if you do a simulation, and here's an example of a simulation, I just want to point out the origin of these more complex shock structures, okay? It's one of the points I wish to make. So here's a simulation. I show density, and I'm hitting an interface at a certain angle here. The reason we chose this because of Brad Sturdivant at Caltech had done some experiments like this. So this is a light medium, so the shock, the transmitted shock is here, by the way. Initially it was planar and coming in and hitting the interface in this position. So this is a sequence of times. Now I just want to point out three things here. In other words, give you faith in the calculation. That's really what I'm trying to do. And at the same time to tell you something about vorticity. So first of all, you push it in here, and by the way, there's anti-symmetry around here, or symmetry in density, anti-symmetry in vorticity. So you get this little mushroom structure, which is a dipole. And an axisymmetry would be a ring. Okay? And so that's one feature. The next feature is, unlike that previous slide that I showed you, the incoming shock does not touch the interface, but stands off it with a Mach shock. Okay? You have to examine this carefully. You'll have to take my word for it. Now, this thing evolves, and it becomes more and more turbulent, but there's actually a structure here which arises, which is certainly seen in addition to here, but this is called the wall vortex, and this is the second one. There's obviously a vortex here, and that's actually seen in experiments.
That looks like a Kelvin.
Yeah, that's just a name given to the roll-up of a vortex layer.
So there's a flow inside in the blue part.
Here?
Yeah,
No. There's no flow. There's just flow behind a essentially one-dimensional shock. The dominant flow is the vorticity on this interface, okay, being convected along by the more or less uniform flow behind the shock. That's the way you have to look at it. In other words, this region here is almost incompressible, okay? All right. And what do I mean by, I don't want to get into a lot of detail because there isn't time, but I just want to show you that I do touch base with reality on a micro level. And I showed you this thing, and now I'm focusing on this object, which is what happens when this interface goes through this medium. This is a shadow graph, so it's not density. And this is the dominant wall vortex. And then later on, it's a little bit hard to see, but you see a structure here, which I have sort of idealized here. And that is associated with the secondary vortex on the interface. The conclusion of that is that, in fact, I have captured, in a qualitative sense, I call that qualitative, what is going on in the experiment. We've also done self-similar studies, that is, not doing evolutionary studies. And here's an example of a self. This is a very busy view graph, but this is the picture of density. You notice.
Pardon?
Pardon?
It
Over?
The whole machine.
Oh.
The machine. There you go.
Yeah, okay. So this shows you the equations we solve. Right. And so when I say self-similar, I have taken the variables x over t and y over t. Okay? So that means I've reduced the order of the differential equation from three variables to two. And when you do that, you are on a different manifold, but you still see that we've captured the triple point here and another triple point here, the wall vortex, which is seen here in vorticity. This is density. This is vorticity. And what you see coming out of these triple points are these two shear layers, and this is the vorticity deposited on the interface, the dominant baroclinic vorticity. So the point that I'm making here is not only do you get baroclinic vorticity at a density interface, but the complexity of the shock interaction with the surface produces other layers of vorticity. These are highly unstable environments, layers of close-lying opposite sign vorticity. For example, a von Karman wake. Okay, let me just show you some of the problems. Now I'm going to show you some work that was done by Ravi Santani, a former student of mine, and Dale Pullen. They compared this self-similar solution for a different configuration with an evolutionary solution. Well, one thing that's clear is this solution rolled up. And that's due to the perturbations from the grid, which is what Mordechai was saying about. Or you can call this the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And this scale size is of the order of the grid size. So the turbulence that you've generated in this simulation at the beginning is driven by the grid. That's right, destabilized.
If it's physically present, I mean, we're not complaining.
If there was some scale present, then it would excite it at that scale, yeah.
Yes.
Right. And we've done some very careful studies of that, and I just wanted to show you. We have algorithms, which I've told Axel about and Mordechai, which extract contact discontinuities and shocks. And here's an example of two codes, just to show you that you take two codes, the Godunov code, which is the basis of second-order accurate codes, and an EFM code, which is a more dissipative code, below. And one of the things that's clear just to the eye is that this, at the same time, these are evolutionary calculations, this has rolled up more than this. Okay? And another thing, the shear layer that's coming out of the triple point here, I meant to emphasize that because it's a recurrent theme. Pardon me?
Which one was correct?
Neither of them are correct.
You don't know that?
Neither of them are correct.
Yeah, but do you expect more or less? Or you know that?
Do you know what's correct?
If there are no perturbations, there is no roll-up.
No, I mean, that's perturbations.
Okay.
How much roll-up should there be?
Well, that's a very subtle question. You have to go in and see how the code is exciting, how the higher order terms in the codes, including the time step, excites perturbations, okay? But one of the things I also want to show you is that this code, this so-called equilibrium flux model, which has the same order of accuracy, is more dissipative. And the way you see that very clearly is that this vortex sheet, by the way, these are two different calculations, is of weaker intensity than this one. Now, if the vortex, by the way, the circulation per unit length is the same. So it conserves circulation per unit length. That's very important. Otherwise, there would be no comparison with reality. But you can see that this is forming an intense vortex, and this hasn't gotten there yet. That's going to make a very big difference in any future time. Okay. There are a lot of issues, and I don't want to get hung up without making some points. So one of the points I want to make is about the so-called collision of vortex sheets, or the collision of vortices. Now, obviously, turbulence is a very complicated vortex interaction, let's say very high Reynolds number turbulence. And you can think of various coherent structures that are important. And 3D is reality, and I apologize for not doing 3D, but the heuristics of complexity are indicated in 2D, okay? Not the vortex stretching term, but some of the heuristics of complexity. And what do I mean by that? By the way, the analog of a dipole or vortex in 2D is the ring in 3D. It's a one-to-one analog. Of course, their stability properties are different. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is show you an evolution. I don't think I had time to show it to you last time. This you can consider a cloud, just a region of an interface. Okay? Of course, I've idealized the problem by, I have so many choices to make, right? I have three media, so I have many choices to make. I have two interfaces, which I've chosen to be planar for simplicity, but I have their angles. I have many choices to make. So I've made the simplest choices. I've made this medium the same as that, okay, this, not colors, and this medium light compared to this. That just picks the sign of the vorticity. It doesn't change anything that I'm saying heuristically. And we call this a gas layer or a gas curtain. People are doing experiments at Los Alamos in this configuration now, except that they're not using the planar one. Now, if you hit that with a shock wave, and this is relatively low, the density ratio is like air helium. I don't have the Mach number here, but I think it shows up in the next one. It's like 1.2, you know, nothing. Well, this is what happens to it at a certain time. Obviously, if you go longer, it becomes much more turbulent. So what is happening? How do you explain this? Well, first of all, this structure, which covers the entire environment now, is rolled up into a small cloud itself.
What's the lower reflecting boundary there?
It's all the grid, or is it the center? Yeah, I mean, this is not the same size as this, okay?
Pardon me?
Yeah, this is just folded over. It's perfectly symmetric around here, yeah.
And the other problem was also supposed to be rotational?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Right, yeah. I'm sorry. I only showed the wind tunnel. And here I just made a fancy picture, okay? I just wanted to point out. So if you looked at this thing, one of the things that immediately catches your eye is this, right? That is this mushroom structure. Very common feature, I say. It's a universal feature. So what is going on? So first, now I'm going to show you the half the wind tunnel, okay? So this is the original configuration. This is the transmitted shock is here now, okay? This is density you're looking at. So you see some complex interaction down here. I'm not going to go into details. And then you see the whole thing lifts off, okay? And then you're here, which is half the picture you saw on the other side, okay? So how do I explain that in a heuristic manner? That is, without getting into a lot of detail about what's going on. Well, I just look at the vorticity, okay? And this is, I would say, one of the essences. This is a sort of stopping point in my talk. But I believe these processes are going on in astrophysics anytime you have shock waves present, because they're constantly colliding with each other and with density and homogeneities. And the only thing you can say is maybe the magnetic field will suppress it. And I buy that, maybe not. Depends on where you are. So let's just get used to arguing this. That is, even in a complex simulation, you can extract certain things and you can see if they're important. If the vorticity is sparse, I'll give that kind of thing, then these processes are going to be very important. If the vorticity is very dense or closely packed, then this is not going to be good, okay? Because the time scale of interaction will be too short. So let's say that we're doing sparse vorticity domains. And in fact, this is what happens. So the shock wave goes by, and it's immediately obvious to you that after the shock wave goes by, the essential problem now is the interaction of two vortex sheets or layers. Why? See, if this were an ideal discontinuity, you would have sheets, which would be an ill-posed problem. But it doesn't bother us because we have layers, so it's a well-posed problem. So you have two vortex layers. Okay, now this vortex layer is positive, and it interacts with its mirror image, which I haven't shown. That will cause it to translate upstream. Plus and minus point vortex will go upstream. This is negative. It interacts with its mirror image and goes downstream. Upstream, I got it wrong. This is downstream, and this is upstream. So what over here, you get a collision. But this is a collision of only the heads of the vortices. And because of certain asymmetries, that is, the circulation has been put on this one later than this one, so this has had less time to sort of interact, you get a non-symmetric interaction, and you get liftoff, and you see the generation of a wake. Some of the vorticity is left behind. At about this time, you can already begin to see the Kelvin-Helmholtz taking place. By the way, if this were done at higher resolution, it would have rolled up. Okay. But the dominant thing that's happening, that's the first order thing that's happening, is you had the collision of vortex sheets, which arose. This is a standard problem in LAM. You fire two dipoles at each other. They go off at an angle. You can look at that and try to see if you can generalize that solution. And I'm calling this kind of complex object a vortex projectile because I think it's an entity that has to be examined. So we're coming along, and now I want to focus on this, what I call the rear side of a bubble. So this work was motivated by, again, Jean-Francois Haas and Brad Sturdivant's paper in JFM. And it motivated Karl Heinz and Paul Woodward and myself in 1987 to look at the shock sphere interaction. Axisymmetric. And let me say now that some people are doing this in 3D, and, namely Richard Klein, I know, for example, is doing this.
Shu and Stone already published 3D simulations of this back in 1995.
Who?
Jim Stone's students.
That's right, but if you look carefully, they also did the ellipsoid, right? And if you look at it, really what they show is that the cloud is formed. Okay, which you could have said would happen without even doing the calculation. Okay, so in other words, there are no statistics, no diagnostics. It showed that they could do the problem, and they don't show very much else. Richard Klein is trying to look at the stability of this, and I'll show you something about what I mean. Yes, right. Okay. Right. Okay. Let me just make one more point, and then I'll close my talk, and we can use this perhaps as a basis for starting again. What happens with the shock sphere? I just want to show you how I argued about this. Okay, Keith, I won't run over too much. I don't want you to leave, actually. Okay. Here's the vorticity plot after the shock wave has passed the sphere. Okay? I'm jumping ahead. I would have motivated a lot of this, so I have to skip ahead. What do you see if I ask you? If I went through and asked each one of you, what do you see in this picture? Well, everybody brings their own background to what they see in a picture, right? And you can argue a lot of physics with visualizations, but you can't do any kind of scaling. So you see this thing. By the way, the shock wave that's caused all this mess is here. Okay? But you see a very strong vortex poking into the shock wave. Where did that come from? That was because this shock wave, when it came around the back, interacted with the shock wave which came up, part of itself. So when two shock waves interact, I just told you, they produce a shear layer. And that's the shear layer. What happened to the shear layer? It rolled up. In fact, it's still being fed by this. See? Another thing you see here is that there's a kink here and a kink here. This kink is because this vortex is so strong, it pushes and deforms the shock wave. So shock vortex interactions in astronomy have got to be important because the shock wave is so strong. You know, this is like, by the way, this is a Mach 10 shock. This is a Mach 10 shock. This is a very high resolution. This is 200 grid points. So you see that even around this ring, this is a vortex ring. Of course, it can't become unstable. It's in 2D. Are layers of opposite sign vorticity. Okay. Now I come here, which is the bubble. So how do you describe what you see here? The first order description is to say, I put negative vorticity, blue is negative, on the upper half, okay? And that's easy to get the sign of the vorticity. I'm not even talking about the magnitude. And this vorticity is rolling up. Well, you would expect that, even incompressibly, if you sent the flow around a a sphere, you'd get a ring generated. That's well known. This is forming a ring, and it looks pretty neat. And I have studies with higher resolution and lower resolution. I can make all that. I don't want to get into that. That's very nice. And I don't even want to talk about how this positive vorticity got inside the cloud. What I want to talk about is this. Nobody has pointed this out before. Where did you get this strong shear layer from, deposited on the inside of the bubble, next to this thing? And I'm going to answer that. Oh, no, I want to show you the consequence of that, okay? And I have one view graph left, okay? This is the consequence of that structure. This is a kind of complex turbulence. The bubble generated all these structures way out here. And, okay, I don't have time to explain it, but I can explain qualitatively why that should have happened. This has never been given in the literature before. Why these structures formed out here. And by the way, if anybody is talking about the stability of this, they better not use a simple model, because it's certainly not simple. Okay. So let me conclude my talk, because I think I've made the main points, and I just want to show one view graph, because this is the last. This is absolutely the last. I'm going to make some conjectures that were sort of discussed in the previous talk and needs. Yeah.
It's actually something I really have to do.
Okay. The filamentary structure of SNR are the result of evolved vorticity, okay, from shocks and blast waves. Now, when we talk about shocks, what do we mean? We actually mean shocklets, that is, regions of finite extent. And they arise in transonic and supersonic flow, and we need statistics and scaling on that. There's no question about that. In fact, one of the things we need is the width of the shock. This is a very important entity, and everybody in the room is discussing the width of the shock by, collision lengths. But in a turbulent medium, the shock width is of the order of a turbulent viscosity divided by mean velocity. Let's discuss that. And the layer width generated at a triple point is also that. So here the shock wave is generating a layer of a certain thickness which generates the turbulence, etc.
Why do you need a turbulent?
Why you need a turbulent?
Why is it the turbulent viscosity that determines?
That's my conjecture. Okay, I can discuss it with you later.
Isn't it the real viscosity?
No. This is usually larger. Maybe not in astrophysics. But it depends. I mean, if this is larger. Berger's shock is such an idealization, I don't even want to get into it. I'm saying that the stirring of the medium is taking place on a small scale, which is introducing a dissipation. It's a dissipation. If the dissipation is associated with the turbulence and not the regular, that is, the collisional viscosity, then the turbulent viscosity will dissipate. Dissipate the energy.
Yeah, but unless the turbulence is really fast, it can't keep up. The shock is moving through faster than the motions of the turbulence. So how can you have
a frozen structure? Yeah, you'll
Pardon?
Run through a frozen structure.
You just run through a completely frozen structure.
Well, that's not what was observed recently by Santani and Pullen. I can show that to you at low Mach number, okay?
High Mach numbers.
But I mean, if it works at low Mach, you can't just dismiss it. I don't accept your argument that you can dismiss it. If it didn't work at low Mach, then you could dismiss it. Okay?
Only if the terminal velocities are somehow supersonic themselves.
So well, in fact, in astrophysical turbulence, they probably are, but I'm still not sure how you could think
well,
of the shock. Exactly. Just
what?
You're just talking about the pre-existing structure and running through it.
That's
what I thought until I read this paper. Okay? But let's pass on for that. You can come back to that. If this is true, I mean, that's why I call it a conjecture, okay? If this is true, then the layers that come out of this shock will be also of that order. That gives a length scale. Of course, that I've ignored completely the problem of stability. That is, these shocks may...
Thickening the shock reduce your vorticity generation?
Yeah, but it doesn't reduce the circulation. Okay, yes, the magnitude of the vorticity and therefore the eddy time is going to be reduced. Yeah. In fact, it's a self-consistent process, so, you know, the turbulence that's generated is affected by, for the next shock that goes by. And of course, as I said at the very beginning, I've ignored all the very important processes in astrophysics which interest me, including things that people brought up just in the previous talk. Current sheets are just as important, right? And finally, who's right? Thanks.
The structure of the shock interface is we can argue about all day, but the basic point is if you have a box full of shocks, so they will run into each other and generate these vortex shields. That's the big thing.
By the way,
it's the dominant vortex generation.
I agree with that.
Well, they do a number on his vortex projectiles because there's a very low mass object, so they don't have much inertia. So when you have a field, say, going perpendicular, it just stops it. Now, the larger scale vortex...
When sheets start forming, current sheets start forming, then you're going to generate very intense layers of current and also vorticity.
But so, remember, magnetic fields also generate vorticity.
I mean, that's right. I mean,
when you share a magnetic field, you actually generate vorticity as well. That puzzled us the first time we looked at it, and then we said, oh, of course.
Right. That would be an effect. You have a pressure. You have a magnetic pressure. Right.
But with magnetic field, I already observed this very dense projectiles, and they are already confined by the magnetic field.
Confined, you mean they don't
move? Yes, they don't skim on the shore.
Yeah, I'm not sure these projectiles. I mean, I've never seen these.
Right. So it's clear here the So we just
I had another comment.
Yeah.
I guess all the diminutions were
we assume that the
field
is very existing and that the vortex has the steady state.
Over,
so
okay,
there is a run of the
solving the energy equation. Because it's likely that I know that clients have done
the
But but as you go to lower and lower effective gamma, I guess the vorticity becomes the vorticity generation becomes less important because you get closer and closer to the constant. You know, like if you go to in the limit of Burgers,
yes,
you have constant
peak.
So you have no pressure gradient.
You can't be counting to 20%.
No, all I'm saying is the ISM, because it pulls, it may have effective gamma.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's because it's cool.
Yeah.
When you compress, you actually cool. Right.
So I'm guessing that many of these vorticity structures will become less constant as you go to more and more effective cooling
flows.
I think that's probably true.
Perhaps I can show you better. We have done a paper with Eureka So on the effects of this varying this effective gamma on the flow of the flow on the generation of vorticity. Although we didn't work very high, but we even did some 3D, and we were looking at the importance of the vortex flexion term components compared to the baroclinic term. It turned out that the baroclinic term was the most important. What we were made to find is that as we go to lower and lower gamma flows, the vorticity seems to disappear from the flow.
Right, in fact, if you look at some theory in the Vidalis, circulation from the lens is linear proportional to gamma, I think. The circulation from the lens, the vorticity, is proportional to gamma.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
That's if the gamma is the same in both media, it doesn't matter. It's much harder.
The other comment is, I guess I agree with you, that it depends on what type of questions you're asking. I was wondering to what extent the global, statistical properties of the flows are affected by these solutions of the codes and things like that.
Which properties.
That's right.
The way I put it is, you can never measure convergence for a code. You can only measure convergence for a question by asking the question at different resolutions of different algorithms.
That's true. That's true. Exactly. Yeah. Depends. If you're looking for a local quantity, you will not converge.
Right.
If you're looking for
those are unanswerable questions of that particular
time. Yeah. Right. If you're looking for global, certain global then you can say, But then the question we're not asking is really that. We're asking for, that's a more subtle thing.
Well, that's why, which paper? Oh, you mean the gravitational collapse paper.
In one of them, you talk about the distribution function.
The Schatz distribution function.
That's right.
Well, there, that's why we actually went and looked to see how much that was changed when we, did things like varying the resolution by large factors, and found that the basic statistical description that we had drawn out of that looks reasonably strong, even though, the details will certainly shift around. And that's our error bar.
Mm-hmm.
That's how much trust we would place in that. In other words, I don't think we could go in with a really good node at really high resolution and really get close changes, although you're going to get changes within our error bars.
I have to look at the paper.
Mike Smith will be arriving, I think, Friday or Saturday, and he'll be staying a month.
cartoons.
How long are you staying?
I'm staying at least a month and a half. I'm going to be away for
Now, he actually has some very nice applications for that to astrophysical observations now. They're looking very promising, which he needs to see as well.
But I'll tell her about it later. Yeah. So, by the way, you know, in this shock bubble problem, you made circulation in the bubble and the circulation outside the bubble.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you find much to our surprise, maybe we shouldn't have been surprised, but you start getting more than that too. The bubble circulation relative to outside.
I guess I want to be very cautious about drawing detailed conclusions from that situation because it appears to be, as I pointed out, indeed, but not physically relevant in detail. I mean, certainly the global conclusion, the shock-shock interaction, or modulo and Mavica's point, is probably valid. But the stuff by Gavada Armand said, he's been trying many different things, explaining many different things with this.
He's looking at data. He doesn't.
He's done, he's taken the basic idea of, a tank killer, right? A collapsing cone shooting a projectile. He's just wandering around looking for some place in the universe where it might apply. But so far he hasn't found it either. Right. I mean, the last thing he was doing was trying to apply it to the fingers in Orion that are observed in infrared. And that didn't work either. I mean, there are better explanations for that. Well, in my humble opinion, as one of the people pushing those other explanations, there are better explanations for that. And the same is true for Vela, the guy who was sitting there, Frank Franco. Actually, has explained not the filamentary structures, but the jets coming out. That's it. He was the guy I was telling you about who wrote a paper on this.
So he explains them linearly tailored?
It's really tailored from the center.
There's another film.
Right. It's rarely tailored facilities in deep and tight supernovae that are just close to now. You have the supernova gap in there.
The first
supernova down here that does rarely tailored facilities in unstable, produce density, and then they just go flying out.
Yeah, right.
And out of shock, they actually just run in. So that's just. These come out more slowly than the surface layers or velocity things like that. The density enhancements are down here somewhere. So this stuff goes out, out to the air shocks, and then the density enhancements.